Hello, everybody. How are you?
Hello.
Good. We're better.
Good. I knew you would be. I knew you would be better. You know, there's a content of today's call, and I know some of the Platinums are very familiar with it because we were at a few workshops together where I shared with you this ritual where you say stop, 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 and you go through this whole process, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So for some of you, it'll be a good review, and for other people, it'll be brand new. But before we get into that, before the call, you were emailed a logo, an image. Do you guys have it in front of you?
Yes.
What does it look like to you? When you look at it, what do you think of? Is this familiar to you, or is this totally strange and alien?
Oh, it's familiar.
What is it?
Isn't it the medical thing or the chiropractic?
That's it. No, you can stop there because that's the answer. That's
okay.
The answer that I always get. It's the medical thing. Now, I want you to know that's the answer if I ask seventh graders, if I ask health practitioners, or if I ask people who work in doctors' offices, they all say the same thing. Isn't it the medical thing? So what is this thing? Can we call it a logo? What is it actually?
Is that really what it is, or does it just look like that a little bit?
No, that's really what it is.
Okay.
You've seen it on doctor's offices. You've seen it on doctor's stationery. At times you've seen it on prescription pads. You've seen it in advertisements for medical offices. So it becomes familiar to you as the medical thing. But nobody's ever explained to you why it's the medical thing. Now, if you saw a toothbrush and toothpaste, you'd go, well, that's the dental thing. And it would make sense because immediately the imagery makes you think of the dentist. If you saw a mop and a bucket, you'd go, oh, that's the cleaning thing because you think of mop and bucket when you think of cleaning. But take a look at this and tell me what it is now. Like, let's get past this kind of vague medical thing. And if you had never seen it before and I asked you to describe it, what are you looking at? How would you describe it?
Hmm.
What is it? Like if you're talking to an artist on the phone and you're going, hey, I want you to replicate this thing. Let me tell you what it is. What would you say it is?
It's a rod with two snakes twirled around it and there's wings at the top. Does it refer to in the Old Testament where the Israelites were getting bitten by snakes and they looked at something that protected them?
Now, Tammy, either you have a very good working knowledge of the Old Testament, or really quick you Googled it. Which one?
Well, no, if I had a really good working knowledge of the Old Testament, I would not have hesitated nearly as much, and it would have been much more specific to the story.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say yes and no, but that's a really good starting point. So the earliest record of this imagery is exactly that, from the Old Testament. And Moses had the responsibility of taking multitudes of people of all ages and shapes through the desert. Now, in the desert, there's no food and there's no water. But Moses knew that they would be provided for. And the people were provided for. Now, we know they were not happy all the way. They were not singing and dancing going, we know we're going to get food and water. Yet, there was this pervading evidence of a higher power that provided them with food and water. So if you are going through the desert and you get food and water, that certainly helps, but it's not enough because there are many dangers in the desert. And you can't run to the nearest ER because the nearest ER is pretty far away. And back then, I don't think the ERs were all that good. So one of the dangers was venomous snakes. So in Exodus, it talks about Moses carrying a rod with a snake around it, with a globe at the top. And this was to assure the people that if you run into a desert danger, you need not fear. If you are bit by a venomous snake, you need not fear. You need only believe. This staff, this rod, is representative of the fact that the globe, which represents God or this higher power, is elevated above the snake. So there was one snake wrapped around this brass rod with a globe at the top. And when somebody ran into this danger, they would look at that rod and realize there is a higher power, and according to the Old Testament, they would be cured. Now this staff or this rod outlived Moses. It was passed along through several generations. And there was a king who possessed this rod, and people would come from far and wide when they were suffering ills or when they were sick, and they would want to stand before the rod. And the king started to realize these people are missing the point. This staff is only a representation. In fact, it's almost bordering on idol worship because people are putting too much stock, too much faith in this finite material object. They need to understand it's not about the object. This was a symbol in the desert. But now people need to understand they need to look directly up. They don't need this rod. So he had it destroyed righteously, because idol worship was something that was forbidden by this higher power. So that was the staff of Moses, or the rod of Moses. Now what's interesting, though, is when we look at this, there's not one snake, but there are two. And they somehow represent medicine. So as we continue to look through a combination of history and mythology, we find that Asclepius, who was actually an ancestor of Hippocrates. Now, guys, stop me if I bore you or if you get lost, because I don't want to give you a history lesson. But I think it's interesting that we look at this medical thing and we have no idea what it is. And I believe when you understand what it is, you're going to view it very differently. As a matter of fact, I suspect you're going to view medicine very differently. And with that, I suspect that you will view what you do for a living very differently. So stop me if either I lose you or bore you. So Asclepius was the first physician on record. If you trace back medicine and go all the way back and say, where's the first actual documented physician, you will find Asclepius. And Asclepius used a number of healing modalities that were available at the time. He had two daughters. One was named Panacea and one was named Hygieia. And these were the categories that his modalities of cure fell under. There was panacea, which meant you take something or you have something done to you. So you either have a surgery or you are administered a potion or some herbs. The other part, we're looking at 50-50, 50%, one daughter was Hygieia, the other was panacea. So the other part, Hygieia, would really be the equivalent of what today we would call wellness. It's breathing the right air. It's eating the right food. It's drinking the purest water. It's quieting the brain. It's moving the body in ways that are therapeutic. So medicine was part panacea and part Hygieia. Now, when we look at the medical field today, they seem to have forgotten about Hygieia. Today it seems to be about panacea. We'll find what's wrong with you, we'll give you a diagnosis, and we'll give you the surgery or the pill or the fix or the drug or the injection. Very little attention is paid to, let's get you eating better, let's get your system clean, let's get the systems of your body working, and let's get your body to heal itself. That's not really a part of conventional medicine anymore, but it was a part of Asclepius' thoughts on medicine. So Asclepius would build these temples. And they were temples because God was, of course, a big part of this. And they had different names for different elements of God or different gods in Greek mythology. As a matter of fact, years later, Asclepius was elevated to the level of a god. He is thought to be a son of Apollo. So Asclepius really lived, but when you look into the legend of Asclepius, it gets a little mythological. Asclepius, around his temples, had snakes because he believed that snakes had healing power. Now, not venomous snakes, a specific type of snake. a snake that can be easily tamed. If you would go to a reptile expert today, he would call it a rat snake. But if you look at the Greek name, the genus of snake, you'll find the word Asclepius in there. So this was the snake of Asclepius. And he believed that snakes were healing in some way. So around his temple lived these very peaceful snakes, and people would go there to be cured. So Asclepius carried a rod, very much like the rod of Moses. It was not the same, but it was a rod with a snake around it. So now we get a little bit of a connection to medicine. If we look at that, we go, okay, I could see why, if he was truly the first physician on record, if Hippocrates was born of Asclepius' descendants, then it makes sense that this logo would come from Asclepius. But are doctors even aware of this? So we've got to look a little differently. We've got to look a little deeper. We have to say, where in history do we find two snakes? What's interesting is there is some imagery of the god Apollo carrying a staff with two snakes, but it is more attributed to Hermes. Hermes was reputed to be one of the greatest knowers in history. And he knew not only of material world, but he knew of spirit world. And Hermes was an educator, and he told people about mind and spirit. And he told people how we are in control of our outcomes, how important thought is, and how we are divinely perfect unless we screw it up. As a matter of fact, the law of attraction can be traced to Hermes. So Hermes had this rod with two snakes. At the top is a globe. So this is called the staff or the rod of Hermes. One snake, the snake on the right, represents divine man. What does that mean? That means the potential for man to be. In other words, before humankind screws anything up, he or she, an individual, has the potential to be perfect in God's image. So the snake on the right, the snake with the head on the right, represents that perfection of man. Now, from the time that this perfection is conceived to the time that the material man is born, something might happen. That material man may not match his perfection, but he still has the potential. And as time goes on, and he gets bruised, and he makes bad decisions, and he puts things in his body or on his body that are not helpful, that material man living in a human body moves away from that divine potential. So when we look at this image, it's almost a mirror image. It's almost one snake looking in a mirror. But I say almost, it's not, because they are intertwined. If it were a mirror, they couldn't actually connect. So Hermes' thinking was, you are connected to your divine perfection. We cannot fully separate you from the divine perfect version of you. So the goal of medicine, the goal of healing, was to look at material man, the individual, and try to identify how we can get this person to match his divine potential. It's not how do we get rid of the wart on his foot. It's not how do we get rid of his cough. It's how do we take what we see before us and bring it closer to its potential so it is truly intertwined. So at its root, at its deepest core, medicine is intended to bring the man or woman, the individual, closer to his or her divine potential. Interesting. Now, the globe at the top still represents this higher power. that this doesn't happen. This doesn't happen without a recognition of something greater responsible for creation. So we take a look at this now, and we understand at a different level why it might represent medicine. Because the intention of medicine at its core is to bring an individual closer to his or her perfection. So now the question, Tammy, Laura, the question is, does this accurately represent conventional medicine today?
No, not at all.
No.
Now, why would you say no? Because I promise you, if you now go to 100 doctor's offices and you explore everything from their door to the little window that the woman sits behind that she slides open, you will find in 100 of them this insignia.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you say it doesn't represent it? It certainly has the intention.
But that's not the practice. In practically speaking, what they're focusing on is symptoms and alleviating symptoms and giving a quick fix to get rid of the symptom.
So it has nothing to do with, based on what you're saying, even a recognition of this concept of divine perfection. It has everything to look at, looking at a bug and swatting it away, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you a different question. If we were to take what you do for a living, anyone on this call, anyone in this group, if we were to take what you do for a living and hold it up against this concept, and we were to take conventional medicine and hold it up against the same concept, who is closer?
We are.
We are, for sure.
Now, you say that, both of you said that without any hesitation. Why?
Mm-hmm. I guess it's a true belief in the fact that it's just a belief. I believe that.
Well, what if a doctor says he believes that? I mean, now the two of you are equal.
But it goes right back to our philosophy that God created your body to heal when the interference is removed. And that's our focus, is removing the interference and teaching you what to do to heal the cell.
Now here's where it gets really interesting. So we're talking about something that has withstood thousands of years just in terms of the imagery, thousands and thousands of years. Different cultures. And we look at this, and I would say it is indisputable that it looks just like a strand of DNA. It also kind of looks a little bit like the way the central nervous system wraps around the spine.
Yeah, it does, definitely. Interesting.
So might we consider that there is, in fact, an ancient wisdom that is far greater than the knowledge that man had at that time? Might there be something here above what people knew? I mean, there was a time that Galileo was considered a heretic because he believed that the earth is not the center of the universe, that the earth moved, and he was imprisoned for that ridiculous thought. So is it possible that there were philosophers or seers, or prophets, that really were able to understand something deeper? Because isn't this concept of divine perfection the perfection of DNA? I mean, we learn now. 10 years ago, somebody would have been locked up if they stood in front of a group of scientists and said, we can change our DNA. They would have said, okay, crazy person, lock him up. But now we know it. So isn't it possible that this knowledge existed long ago, but just never found its way into the medical field? That at its root, this intention was exactly what you are trying to do, removing interference so perfection can return. Removing interference so the body that was programmed divinely can find that divination. Because it does look like that.
Yeah.
Now, I'll give you one more little tidbit to think about. There are 7 points where the snakes intersect or touch. If you're familiar at all with yoga or Eastern philosophy, what does the number 7 bring to mind if you're looking at the body?
Are there 7 chakras?
There are 7 chakras, 7 power centers. So I find it not only incredible, and I can keep going. I mean, the study of this caduceus can really become a thesis or a long time study because it runs so deep. But there's something here that really represents an extreme wisdom that ironically is not even recognized in conventional medicine. Considering that perfection may be returned by recognizing the perfection of the nervous system. Considering that perfection may be returned by representing the power centers. And considering that perfection may be returned by fixing our DNA. So when I share this, I don't think there's anyone who could dispute that this is a very noble pursuit. In other words, if our medical field really operated this way, they would truly and probably appropriately be revered. The word healer would take on a totally different meaning. So if this represents you, and I'm not asking you to steal the logo, I'm just saying, understand the intention of medicine that has been corrupted and recognize what you do. Where is the greater value? Now, I don't like to, you know, throw that concept out of pitting you against medicine, but I do know it's a very real concern. I know that everybody I meet who is a accomplished health coach or a chiropractor who has stepped into this world of functional nutrition at some level feels, I'll say frustration to be polite, I'll say resentment if I'm going to be more honest, toward the medical field. Not that they dislike the doctors, but when they look at the money that is being spent on an industry and a pursuit that has no hope of truly restoring that divine perfection, there's got to be some resentment where you go, I get up every day and I try to do this for people. Why don't I have that kind of revenue? Why don't I have that kind of income? And granted, you guys do well. But you cannot help but look at that comparison at least some of the time. Why? Because it's in your face. Because everyone you meet says, I went to this doctor and this doctor and this doctor. Mm-hmm. I went to an endocrinologist, a gastroenterologist. They said this, they said that. I'm on 17 medications. I'm worse. So you can't help but look at that and go, this person not only wasted energy and hope, but dollars. And suddenly I sound expensive at $6,000 when they've already spent $50,000 on nothing. So anecdotally, I took a look at this. And I just outlined 7 points. 7 points that I believe have value. So if we look at where the two snakes intersect, let's start at the very first one, which really means there's value there. This, again, is simply my interpretation. But I looked at this and I said, at its lowest, yet there is something, the tails are touching, what would the minimal value be if really the intention was to restore somebody to their divine potential? And I would say the part of the provision that has value is human connection. As a matter of fact, loneliness creates a very similar destructive endocrine reaction to fear. So when people feel a sense of isolation when people feel a sense of loneliness and they go from doctor to doctor to doctor, do they ever really feel a true human connection? No, they feel like they're supposed to appreciate the 7 minutes. And then they're sitting waiting for the results of the lab tests. Is there truly a human connection? I started working with groups of psychologists, which is a new field for me. Very similar, by the way. But a lot of them feel like, and I don't think I'm giving away any secrets here, but a lot of them feel like their patients come to them more than anything else because it's almost like rent-a-friend. And they feel guilty. The psychologists feel guilty because they have to sit and listen to a person in pain. But nobody in this person's life is willing to listen. And then the hour's up. So the psychologist has a really good intention. They want to help this person, but they need to preserve their value. So the question that I put before them is, are people getting value? Not are people getting the maximum value, but are they getting value in that human connection even if they're paying for it? And the answer has to be yes. For many years, I lived in the field of fitness and personal training. I would say the great majority of trainers never get results for people, at least not the results people want. But there's some benefit to the human connection. They hang out and talk to somebody while they do their curls and while they walk on the treadmill. So in comparing the relationship a patient has with you to the relationship a patient has with the doctor, if you agree with me that there is some value in human connection, in caring, who does this better, you or the doctor?
Us, for sure.
We do.
For sure. There's no question. So now let's go up a rung. Let's say, okay, now human connection offers some value. There should be a value to it, but we offer greater value. So what would be kind of the next level or the second place that the snakes intersect? And I would say that would be information, where the patient actually learns. There's value in human connection, but there's greater value in human connection with somebody who teaches you, who helps you understand why the things that used to work for you to lose weight don't work anymore. Why, even though you're eating well, you don't have energy. So who does this better in helping the person understand? I don't think we even need to ask the question. I think it's pretty clear.
Yes.
Yes.
Let's go to the third one. I think above inform would be empower. Mm-hmm. Because doctors may make a lame attempt. I'll share this. And I believe me, I never want to sound as if I'm putting down doctors. I admire doctors tremendously. But I realize the flaws in the system. And I see where the patients fail to get the value they hope for. And I think already, just with the bottom two, human connection and information, they're lacking there. I know an endocrinology group in Hollywood, Florida, that before they prescribe blood sugar medication, they require that the patient watches a 45-minute video. And they have a separate room where the video plays on a loop. So they actually require, before we give you the prescription, you've got to watch this video. It's a really good video. It has a few celebrities in it. It's hosted by Sanjay Gupta. It's a good video. And I think that's noble because they're trying to inform the patients. But casually, I asked these doctors a question. I said, what percentage of the patients do you think make change based on what they learned in the video? And they said less than 5%. So they're kind of dismissing the possibility that the patients will even do anything. So they say, oh, you know, we want to be better, so we're going to offer information. But it's not enough. So the third rung would be actually empower people, not only teach them, not only get them to understand why, but give them the ability to make shifts. Give them some tools to reverse inflammation. Give them a strategy so they can get their amalgams taken out and actually feel better. Now we go to the fourth one. The fourth one would actually be bring about change. Now I would say the doctor brings about change quickly. The doctor may bring about a change in biochemistry by prescribing a medication. The doctor may bring about a change instantly by removing something that didn't belong. But how about giving the person the power to change? If anything, I think the medical perspective robs them of that. It's almost like, don't think, don't worry about it. We'll put you to sleep. When you wake up, it'll be gone. So there's little in the way of information. There's little in the way of empowerment. And there is a change, but is it a change that the patient can take ownership of? Let's go to the next rung. Deliver progressive change. What do I mean by that? If you have somebody who's very overweight and you do a gastric bypass and you reduce the size of their stomach and they lose 80 pounds, they have now lost 80 pounds in a sense because the one system that was working well has been destroyed. They are malnourished, but they achieved a change and they think it's a change they hoped for. But can that person now bring about progressive improvement? No. As a matter of fact, they're quite likely to move in the other direction because they were never informed, they were never empowered. Let's go to the next rung. The next rung would be a lasting change, meaning you had a condition, you don't have it anymore. You were given a label. You got the Hashimoto's label. And you got to pull it off. It's not even there anymore. You don't have it anymore because it's a lasting change. When we look at this comparison, step by step by step, how come we're not viewed as more valuable? It doesn't seem just. It doesn't seem righteous. It doesn't seem fair. The problem is, the concept of the logo is not understood. It is not understood by the public. It is not understood by the medical field. In fact, it is not understood by you guys until now. So I think at the very least, when you start to consider everything that I said, when you look at this, you should get a sense that your pursuit is not only noble, it is far more valuable than you've ever given yourself credit for. Dr. Papa talks about the black pearl, and everybody responds to that. Yeah, I need to charge more. Forget I need to charge more. I'm worth more. I'm really worth more because look at the immense value I deliver. And if somebody pays you $10,000 or $12,000, but you take them all the way up to the seventh intersection here, the top of the DNA strand, that would be what I call a transgenesis. It's beyond a lasting change. It is the recreation of that divine perfection. It is bringing somebody to a place that, in essence, they were physically reborn where every cell is different than it was. Every system is different than it was. Transgenesis, meaning traveling to a new beginning, where you've taken somebody through a progression where they can now say, yes, this is how I was supposed to look and feel. When you bring somebody to that level of change, if they've paid you $25,000, nobody will ever come back and say, you ripped me off. Never. So I share this for consideration, just for you guys to really take a look at this, only to represent value. Because anytime you have an issue with what you're asking a patient for, consider this and simply compare it to what the medical field has their professionals charge without batting an eye. Any thoughts, comments, questions on anything that I shared?
I love it, Phil. You know, even just a little different take after listening to you, it kind of also may help us be able to identify at what stage is our client in. You know, it's almost like, you know, the phases of change or let's say the stages of grief or something like that. You know, this may be similar, you know, where I have maybe a lot of clients where I have them maybe in the empower phase, and I can see that developing within them. They feel empowered, and then some of them are bringing change about themselves, which now that I think about it, I may get a little frustrated that they're choosing to change things on their own without passing it by me first. But really, in thinking about it after you explain it, it's a positive thing. I can now maybe say, okay, they're in this phase of bringing about change in their own life, and now I know how to kind of flip that to get them to recognize, I'm so proud that you are taking the bull by the horns, per se, and wanting to induce change in your own life. Now let's think about how this matches the goals moving forward to progressive change. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
So I love it.
You know, I'll give you an interesting insight just from my own life. There was a time where I was well recognized for being somebody who brought about change. And I had books, and I would do seminar tours, and I would be on TV, and I would be on the radio. And there were certain comments that people would make. And one of them was, thank you for changing, fill in the blank. You know, thank you for helping me lose 40 pounds. Thank you for getting me back to the shape I was in college. Thank you for... And every time I would hear this, it was kind of a knee-jerk for me, and I guess it came across as humble, and I'd like to believe it was sincere, but I would say, I didn't do it, you did it, I just gave you the power. And, you know, so many times I said it, it's never like I wrote that down, but it just became something that would just roll off my tongue because I'd hear the thank you all the time. I'd say, I didn't do it, you did it, I just gave you the power, because I would educate and inform people. And today, I would never say that. To me now, that sounds arrogant. It sounds as if I had a power to give them. And I realized today, I was just a channel. It's not my power. It is the divine power that I had the privilege of being able to share with somebody. I was simply a vehicle through which that power came to them. So when I look at this, that's what I see. I see this divine potential is already in them. So if you can view yourself as very simply a catalyst for the release of that power, what an immense privilege that is. And I don't think doctors think of themselves that way. So when you say, yeah, I'm seeing it as a kind of a progressive step, where now I can look at somebody and say, I'm so proud of you because, well, yeah, that's exactly right. You're so proud of them because you are serving them and giving them access to a power that lied within them the whole time. So when we look at the intention, when we look at the globe on the top, then what a beautiful way to approach making people better, as opposed to let's find the problem and remove it. Let's find the measurement that's off and find the drug that brings it back. So I like that perspective that you just shared, and I share it with you, and I hope everybody here does, because when you start to appreciate that the relationship with a patient is not until you fix the problem, it is until you give them enough so they can bring about that true transgenesis. That's when you've really done what you're intended to do. And when you look at the value of that, it's extreme. It's almost non-quantifiable. Any other thoughts?
It's
okay.
Like a different roadmap. You know, the roadmap that we use in TCD,
mm-hmm.
It's just a different kind of roadmap.
Yep.
Right. And you know, thinking about some of my clients, those that get further through each of these steps really do better overall.
Good. So I'm glad you guys received that in the spirit with which I intended to deliver it. So thank you for that. Now,
how do you spell Asclepius?
A-S. Uh-huh. Oh, I hate when I get spelling tests. A-S-C-L-E-P-I-U-S.
Thank you.
It's at least close to that. A-S-C-L-E-S-C-L-E-P-I-U-S. P-I-U-S. Yep, that's it.
Yep, you got it, because my OneNote got rid of that little squiggly red line because I spelled it wrong.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm glad I could correct it for you.
Yes.
All right, listen, now on the next call, which is our last call in this group, we're going to have some options. But I would like at least five of you to participate. I know Sarah gets excited about this call because we've been through it with a prior group, and it's not only fun, it's just really powerful. But being the last call, I leave you guys in control of it. But I want to keep it under a specific outline. So I would ask five of you at least to participate, and I would ask you to make a reservation literally with Sarah to grab one of these five options. Now I'll tell you
or,
that
or
the...
Andrea.
What's
or
that?
Andrea. Or Andrea. I'll fill Andrea in.
Yeah, sorry, Andrea. I'll say Sandria, because you guys are sort of like connected. The last call, which is 2 weeks from now, might be 10 minutes or might be 2 hours, and it's entirely up to you. I'm not going to force the call just to meet a time restraint. It's up to you guys. So here's what I'm going to ask. One person will choose what I call the hot seat. Here's how the hot seat works. And by the way, if I were in the group, I would choose this immediately. I would just take it, because when we look at value, there's a lot here. So the hot seat is you share a challenge, you share a problem from your own life, from your own career, and the members of the group offer advice and direction. It's kind of peer counseling. And it's really valuable because by this point, most of you have managed to strip away the ego, have connected to at least some of the concepts we've discussed. So you can speak to the challenge in the language of the group. Maybe you'll say that you're plagued by the negative talk monster. So you now have a group that understands what you're talking about, and they will coach you forward. So that, I believe, is the greatest option of all. You do, though, have to be a little vulnerable because you've got to put it all out there and you've got to be willing to listen. You can't argue. If somebody says something from their perspective that stings a little bit, you got to take it. That's why it's the hot seat. The second option is just to share any anecdote, any story that has a lesson to it that will benefit the people in the group. Something that you went through or something that you witnessed or something that you learned that you can share from your own life that other people go, oh, yeah, yeah, I get that. The third option would be share a principle that you learned in Be Better, any principle that we discussed, the EEM, the PFC, the RAS, the reach, the funnel, the spillover, the life cycle of business, staying in prime, nudging the needle, anything at all. But you share a principle and you go, here's one that I really connect with. And you'll talk about how it impacted you. Or if it's one that you really resonated with but didn't act on, you'll talk about that. You'll talk about the fact that you neglected to implement it and you're now ready to optimize it. The fourth would be a bold statement. A bold statement, an outcome that hasn't happened yet. But you've got to tell us with certainty where you'll be, when you'll be there, and how you know it will happen. And the fifth is I'm going to introduce you to or reintroduce you to a ritual that I'm going to ask you to do every day for the next 2 weeks. The power is not in the ritual. The power is in doing the ritual every day. So, you know, as a simple metaphor, if somebody had the greatest exercise routine in the world and you did it once, you're not going to see any benefit. So the power is not in the routine. The power is in using the routine on a regular basis. And what I'm about to share with you works only if you do it every single day, because the whole idea is you are stimulating change in your mental wiring, in your neural wiring. And if you neglect to do it, you never get that change. So the fifth option is just talk about the change that took place by doing the ritual for 2 weeks. And I'm promising you this. Everyone who does it for 2 weeks is going to experience a change. If you don't, I can't make any promises. But if you do it for 2 weeks, you will have a change to share, a good one. All right, so ritual. I keep saying this word ritual. And I know that sometimes the word ritual sounds kind of creepy, right? Like a ritual? Why do you want us to do a ritual? Kind of sounds like the Salem witch trials. What kind of ritual? Why do we do that? And what I want you to understand is we live by rituals. We are ritualistic creatures. So is your dog. So is your cat. Sometimes they have weird idiosyncrasies, but they do the same thing all the time. Some cats throw the food out of the food dish before they eat it. Why? I don't know what's going on in the cat's mind, but it becomes a ritual. Some dogs curl up the same spot on the couch every single day. So, okay, we see it in pets and we accept it. I want you to start to realize you do it too. Tailgate parties are rituals. The things that we do on the hierarchy of needs pyramid, we do for survival. Tailgate parties isn't on there. So why do so many people do it, let alone for years? You go to your city, you go to your closest football team, your NFL team, and you go to a tailgate party, and you will meet people who say, we've been doing this in the same spot for 30 years. They're eating hot dogs, they're drinking beer. They could have done that at home, but they're not. They're doing it in a parking lot. Why? Because it's a ritual. When a team wins a championship, they pour Gatorade on the coach. Why? Does it make him a better coach? No. Is it because he's in need of a shower? No. It's just a ritual. We're all subject to rituals. Now, I say it's not a need, but maybe it is, because rituals are a part of bonding. And at an independent level, as crazy as this sounds, they contribute to our confidence. You may say, I'm not superstitious, yet if you participate in a sport, you might have a ritual. Athletes are notorious for having rituals. My friend Mike has a fishing shirt that he wears. He will not go fishing without the fishing shirt. Now today, he's probably 210. When he got the shirt, he was probably 165. So he literally cut the seams on the side. The shirt doesn't fit him. It looks ridiculous. But he won't go fishing without that shirt. Logical? No. Rational? No. Ritual? Yes. Next Thursday, I think it is. My whole extended family is getting together at my sister's house. Now, what I'm dreading is the discussion about Donald Trump. I know it's coming. I know my sister's husband will make this conversation happen. And I know it gets to yelling and shouting. It's going to happen. I also know we're going to eat turkey. I know my sister will make pies, and everybody will want to taste every pie. And we'll go, this is really good. You've outdone yourself. I know. I know football games will be on. I know somebody will be asleep on the couch. I know my daughter and her cousin will be outside climbing a tree. I know. How do I know? It's a ritual. You guys will all have turkey. I don't have to be a psychic. It's a ritual. We all do it. So I want you to get comfortable with that word, because there's nothing creepy about it. I see guys in the gym who have bizarre rituals before they lift. You know, power lifters, watch them. They always put the same knee wrap on first. They take the same number of breaths before they do a squat. They do the little bounce. It's a ritual. Because it gives them a confidence. They're following a ritual that seemed to have worked before. It gives them a sense of comfort. So when you think about it, when you watch somebody, even your pet, doing a ritual, they're not thinking about it. Last time I spoke about this earlier in the week, I talked about a friend of mine who brushes her hair upon waking up 100 times. Now, if she stopped at 99, if I grabbed her hand and said, stop, I'm promising you she will have a terrible day. All day long, she'd want to get that other brush. If I took the brush and put it in my pocket, she would have a horrible day. Her hair does not look any different, but for some reason, this ritual is important to her. So she doesn't wake up in the morning and think about it. She doesn't, like, write now in her to-do list, I will brush my hair. It's just wired in, because when you do a ritual again and again and again, it just gets wired in. So what you're going to do with this ritual is literally wire it in on purpose, intentionally. The challenge is going to be, because it's not wired in now, your EEM will resist it. Your EEM will give you thoughts like, this is silly. You don't need to do this. You could just make the change anyway. So I want you to be aware, because that opens the door for negative talk to show up. So even though there are parts of your brain that will listen to what I say and completely reject it now, if you want to make a change for the better, nothing will wire it in, make it feel automatic, like this ritual. Is it logical? No more logical than brushing your hair 100 times when you get out of bed. But does it work? The idea here is to use senses and emotion together. You can't just go through it for the sake of doing it. You can't go through the motions. The two necessary elements here are your senses, meaning your sight, your sound, your touch, your smell, your senses and your emotion. And you will go through a number of emotions, but one of them has to be kind of burdensome, kind of heavy. And the other one has to be joyous, even blissful. And other emotions will show up. You need complete buy-in, or the negative talk monster will take over. So the idea here is to just take some shackles and just shackle that negative talk monster. So the ritual goes like this. Stop, stop, stop. Tammy, I know you've done this with me before.
Yes.
Do you have any experience to share with it?
Yes. I did it every night for three, well, let me take that back. I think I may have missed one night for 3 months when we first learned it. And I was focusing on changing the results that I get at my talks and mm-hmm. getting more signups. And what it changed for me is what you said earlier. It contributed to my confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So that after that, because there are some things we can't control. If your Facebook ad just doesn't perform and you only have two people at your talk, you're not going to get 10 new clients that night. You're just not. So what it did for me is it got rid of the feeling that I had before that there must be something wrong. Why can't I make this work? This is just all of that negative talk, huge negative talk. It got rid of that and gave me more confidence.
So are you willing to now try it again now that you're at a different level?
Yes.
The other thing is, I know, Tammy, when you did it, it was part of a workshop.
Yes.
So you witnessed, and I don't know how much of it you felt, but you witnessed very intense emotion because we're doing it in a group, right?
Yeah.
There's applause.
Mm-hmm.
There's hugging.
Oh,
you know, people break into tears.
Yeah.
They do their little victory dance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the power of it, and it's really hard for me to deliver that impact on a call like this.
Yeah.
But I want you guys to try to receive it and do it as if there's a group watching you and they're all behind you. So here's how it works. You say stop, stop, stop. Okay, now what are you stopping? You have to begin by getting yourself in a state where you are feeling the discomfort of that which you want to change. We all want to be better. That's why we join groups. That's why we go to seminars. We want to be better. So if we want to be better, it means there's something in your life, in my life, in the life of everybody in this group, that we are not comfortable with. It doesn't mean we're suffering. It doesn't mean we're in agony. But there's something we like to change. For some of you, it's your income. For some of you, it's your lifestyle. For some of it, it's some of you, it's your relationships. For some, it's more material. Whatever it is, nobody's going to judge it. If you think of the creative tension diagram, and if you need to go back and look at it, you have it in your downloads. There's a circle and there's a rectangle. And the rectangle is higher than the circle. And I gave you the analogy or the metaphor of an escalator. So in the rectangle, you would write down where you'd like to be, what your desired outcome is. The circle is where you are now. So when you're starting the ritual, it's as if you're standing in the circle. You're kind of isolating yourself in the where you are now, but you're focusing on whatever brings you the discontent. Now, I know we've all learned to think positive. So we don't want to get mired down by negative thoughts, so you're going to have a resistance to this. But I want you to understand, this is not to mire you down. This is the opposite. This is to throw you out of that, to get you to leave it behind. And the best way to force your brain to form new wiring to get you away from something is to feel it, to actually feel the discontent. So the power you have to stop it is simply to say, stop, stop, stop. Stand in a shopping mall and just wait until the right moment and just yell at the top of your lungs, stop! And every single person will stop walking. For a second, they'll look, they'll see if there's anything, and then they'll start going again. Because we're wired for that. We've learned. Red light means stop. Stop sign means stop. So the word stop says to your brain, freeze. So you're now playing this program. You're thinking of the discontent that you have now. And as soon as you say, with intention, stop, 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 your brain stops for a second. It suddenly becomes deer in headlights. But it stops running that program. Now, if you just stood there and didn't do anything else, it would start playing it again, which is why there's a ritual that brings you out of that quickly. When you say stop, 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 you don't only say it, you say it forcefully, not angrily. We don't want anger here. But as if you know you have the power to stop running this program. And you use your hands out in front of you as if you're standing in front of traffic and saying stop. So both hands, you say stop, 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 and you use your hands. Now your eyes are closed because you want to create a multi-sensory experience. So let's just say you hate where you live because you look out at a garbage dump, and I know nobody here does, but I just want to give you an example. So you keep your blinds closed, you hate to look at the garbage dump because it's in your backyard. And every time you look out your window, you go, oh, I hate where I live. So in your vision, you are standing at that window looking at the garbage dump. Now you hate it. You hate it. You hate it. This is the garbage you want to get rid of. So your instinct is to stop thinking about that. But in this exercise, you don't want to. You want to feel your discontent. So if your eyes are open and you're really looking at your computer, you're not going to get the imagery right. You want to convince your brain that this is really happening. So in your vision, you are literally looking at the garbage, and you're smelling the garbage. And you're hearing the sound of the ugly birds and vultures that fly over the garbage dump. You want to make this as multisensory as possible. So in the physical, you're literally standing in your bedroom in a spot that is a circle. You don't have to really draw a circle, but based on the creative tension diagram, your eyes are closed, you're imagining standing in this circle. You close your eyes and you picture whatever it is that you are discontent with. If it's your income, maybe you're picturing the painful moment, whatever that was, the call you got from your bank, the bill collector, the opening of the credit card bill. If it's the fact that you're too busy at work, then I want you to think about a moment at work where you actually feel that, where you want to go home and there are still patients waiting to see you. And I want you to hear them. I want you to smell them if there's a smell to them, literally. So you're standing in this figurative circle and you're feeling, sensing this moment of discontent. When we do this live in workshops, most of the time you can see, because the person has their eyes closed, you can see the pain. Sometimes it's a tear, sometimes it's many tears, sometimes it's sobbing. Sometimes it's just the facial expression. Sometimes it's the body posture rounds forward. Because they're really feeling it. Now, again, I know there's an apprehension to going to a negative feeling, but understand, this is real. You're picturing something from your life. You're just shining the spotlight on it. Not because you want to feel bad for long, because you want to realize you don't need to be here anymore. You have the power to get out of it. So once you're feeling the intensity of emotion, you say, stop, stop, stop. Now, the best way to do this is to literally identify two spots on the floor. Do it in the same place every day. Two spots on the floor, one that would represent the circle and the other that would represent the rectangle. And you're just imagining this. You don't really have to put a circle and a rectangle on your floor. So you start by standing in the circle. You close your eyes and you get yourself in that state of feeling the negativity of that which you want to change. When it feels intense, you say, stop, stop, stop. And you literally take a step out of the circle toward the rectangle. So the creative tension line, if you remember, is the line that runs from the circle to the rectangle. So you're taking a step along the line. What you're saying to your brain is, I just moved toward my outcome. There are lots of elements of NLP in here. There are elements of neuroplasticity. There are elements of neural rewiring. But your brain receives the signal that you have stopped it and stepped out of it. Now, when you step out of that circle, I want you to picture, envision, feel that you are stepping into mud, that you take a step out and your feet are kind of sinking. Now, you don't really have to bring mud into your bedroom, but I want you to use your imagination because that's the fuel here, imagery. So you step out of the circle into mud. But the mud is not negative because as you're standing there, you feel a bright light shining on you from the direction of your outcome, from the direction of your rectangle. So you're standing in a circle, you're feeling discontent. Stop, 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 and you take a step. Your feet are in mud, but you feel a bright light shining on you. Here's what this tells your brain. You're not there yet, but there's something really appealing, really compelling that you just took a step toward. And now you're going to acknowledge that you're stuck because that's the whole root of the problem. You're stuck. Now, your rational mind and your EEM want to blame. Your ego wants to blame. Your ego cannot accept that this is your fault. So it wants to blame. So if you just let your ego speak and you start by saying, I'm stuck, it'll say, I'm stuck because of the economy. I'm stuck because my husband doesn't want to change. I'm stuck because if I move, I'll have to take my kids out of their school. I'm stuck because a really bad thing happened. I'm stuck because I had the unexpected expense. You're going to find something to blame. So you have a very specific reason why you're stuck. And you don't have to blame yourself, but you can't blame something else. So what do you blame if you can't blame yourself or something else? You blame your limbic system because that's what it is. You are stuck because of your limbic system. Why can 10 people have the same opportunity and all 10 of them achieve different outcomes? You can say because of their willingness, because of their drive, because of their determination, because of their emotions. Where does all that live? In the limbic system. So you step out of the circle, out of the discontent, you're standing in the mud, and you say, I am stuck only because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. This is really powerful because your limbic system, the emotion part of your brain, receives this. It's going, oh, I'm cross-wired? And when you say this, you're going to have your arms crossed in front of you. The best visual I can give you is if you've ever watched America's Got Talent, when there's a bad act on and the audience is booing and they're like making the X, you know, with their arms. So you're standing and you're stepping out of the circle into the mud, and you're saying, with your arms crossed, just like that, I am stuck because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. And I choose to rewire. And when you say that, you uncross your arms. Here's what you're telling your brain. Change the wiring. Physiology communicates this to your brain. The more senses you activate, the more powerful it is. So it's not just the words. It's the words, it's the emotion, it's the belief, and it's the physiology. Your brain is receiving this as a very impactful message. And as soon as you do that, as soon as you uncross, you're changing the wiring in your limbic system, you step toward that rectangle happily. You feel good because now you step out of the mud. You just got unstuck. And then you come up with a present-based affirmation, a statement that starts with, I am. We've spoken about labels. We've spoken about how the doctor says you are a diabetic, and from that moment on, somebody says, I am a diabetic. You are depressed. I am depressed. You're going to create your own identity here. Something that really resonates with you, and you're going to say with passion, I am more confident than I've ever been. I am powerful and strong. I am a great manifester. I am deserving of greatness. I am on my way to affluence. So here's what you're doing. Your brain is just following along, going, yeah, yeah, things really suck. Yep, this really stinks. Uh-huh. Everything's really bad, and this is just the way life is. And suddenly you go, stop, and it freezes. And now you step out, and you go, listen, I'm stuck, but I'm stuck only because of crosswiring in my limbic system. And your limbic system wakes up and goes, huh? I have to change. And now you immediately go to a sense of happiness and power. So in this state of happiness and power, you can create. You can't create in a state of depression, but in a state of happiness and power, you're stating what you are. You're giving yourself the identity that says, I am powerful. And your brain receives that. Your EM doesn't hold back. You just told your EM, I'm powerful. I'm more powerful than you've acknowledged. And then, with this power, you step into the rectangle. Now, again, it's not a physical rectangle, but it's movement along that line until you get to the outcome. When we do this live in groups, I ask people to do this out loud. So their eyes are closed, but they're standing in their future. They've literally arrived at their future memory. And they describe it. Why describe it? Because it's more powerful. It's more sensory. So they're now standing in the rectangle. So my advice to you is, even if you're home by yourself, describe it as if there are people listening. And by the way, if you have a really supportive spouse, let them listen. Let them join. Let them applaud. Let them hug you afterwards, because they're sharing in this outcome. If you don't have a really supportive spouse in this regard, then certainly do it in a different room. Because if your spouse will be in the room, he or she has to buy in. Otherwise, negative talk shows up. So in the rectangle, you step into your future memory and you describe what you're seeing, what you're feeling. You just went into the future, so what's there? Maybe it's you're leaving work at 3 o'clock, so you're talking about it. You're seeing the clock. It says 5 minutes to 3, and you're leaving. And you're not getting into the car you drive now. You're getting into your convertible that you always wish you had. So you're describing this. You're standing in one place, but in your imagery, you're moving. And the speaking out loud is important because you hear your own voice, so it creates a loop. You feel ecstatic. You think of ecstasy. You speak of it. Now, when you speak, guess what? Your ears hear what you say. So now you hear it, and then you feel it, and then you think, and it loops. And this works to cement a new PFC pathway. Now, you stay in it, raising the intensity of the positive emotion. When we do this in workshops, I'll ask somebody on a scale of 1 through 10, where is the emotion right now? And they go, 7. I go, make the image brighter. Where are you now? They go, 8. I go, what are you hearing? They go, children laughing. I go, make it louder. Where are you now? 9. And you see their physiology change. You see them smile, sometimes tears of joy. Sometimes they start to literally tremble. They're so excited. And when you bring it up to a 10, your brain is receiving this as if it is truly happening. So the new pathway is starting to form. Neurons are connecting as if you're really living this. And when you bring it up to a 10, there needs to be some sort of celebration. Now, you only need to celebrate for 2 or 3 seconds, but it could be a jump. It can be a scream. It can be a laugh. Sometimes I say to people, do your victory dance. Do your celebration dance. And they go, what's my celebration dance? I go, I don't know. Let's just see it. And they, sure enough, they do it. When we do this in workshops, in that moment, when they celebrate, everyone runs over and hugs them. Why? Because it cements it. Doesn't mean you need people to hug you, but I want you to understand the emotion is what makes it powerful. So I want you to do this every day until our next call. Is it hard to do? It's up to you. You can make it hard to do. You know, it's like people go, I'm going to work out first thing in the morning, and then they go back to sleep. And then they go, it's really hard to work out first thing in the morning. Is it, or did they just make a decision? So there are some of you who will do this, and I'm promising you, you will notice a change. Maybe it'll be a change in confidence, like Tammy. Maybe it'll be a change in outlook. Maybe it'll be a change in income. In other groups, things happen that were inexplainable. I've had people say, I don't know why, the videos that I had on YouTube that never got attention, suddenly I'm getting 20 people a day responding. And they, why? And I go, I don't know why. Just go with it. It's happening. I've had people envision a physical outcome and achieve it. Envision a possession and get it. Is it magic? No. It's simply using your imagination and your will to change your belief system, which ultimately changes your outcomes because you do different things. You behave differently because your brain is different. Sarah, anything you want to say to echo the importance of this?
Sorry, I was on mute. I don't know that I could add anything more than what you said. The last group that we had huge success in it, and I think it does sound a little bit hokey when you first hear it, but as you go through the ritual, I think that's when you experience the differences. So, and I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, but this has been used in not only elite trainings in our, among our doctors, but also other groups outside the Dr. Pompa crew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, we are fascinated by the concept of change. And so people pursue different paths looking for change. And when we talk about psychology, I mean, if you go to Barnes & Noble and stand in the psychology section, the self-help section, you could probably come home with 10 books that all promise to make you better. And they could read all of those books and try all of the things in those books. And maybe 7 or 8 years from now, you will have mastered the things you learned in those books. And maybe 3 years from then, you'll start to really appreciate the change it brought about. Because at that point, your brain has rewired. You can go through years of Freudian therapy. You could meet with your psychiatrist 4 times a week for 6 years and get to the root of why you feel sad. And at that point, when you release it, now your brain can change. All this does is bring about the mechanical change without having to do all that work. So it is a shortcut, but it's a legitimate shortcut. I feel like if you want to take years to figure out why you're stuck, do it. But most people don't want that. So I'm saying, regardless of why, bring about the change, because what brings about the change is a change in your wiring. Stop running the old pattern. Stop running the old ritual-driven pattern that happened to you by accident. And do a ritual that creates it by intention. So my wish is that all of you do this every single day. My belief is that some of you will. My certainty is that those of you who will see a change in only 2 weeks. Any final thoughts, comments, questions from anybody?
I'll just say I thank you, Phil, for this knowledge, because I've been struggling for quite some time now with the negative talk. I don't feel like it began with me. I feel like it began with my patients, and because we're so in tune with them, and now we're sort of immersed within their problem and within their life, we can easily bring on their problems or bring on their way of thinking, bring on their negativity. So I felt that transition happen to me, and I've been really struggling with getting rid of that, and I haven't figured that out yet. And I feel like what you just took me through is the answer. And
good.
I think because it's a constant thing that all of us are going to face with every patient we see, we just don't know what baggage they're going to bring into that relationship. And I feel like this may also be a ritual that will help protect our being in our thoughts, you know, from their baggage too. So thank you.
Yeah, you know what? The louder voice wins. So in other words, if you're driving home from work, replaying in your head what your last sad patient said to you, replaying it again and again and again, not on purpose, because it's sort of like you heard a song that stays in your head. And then there's emotion attached to it because you feel there's empathy. You're sad. And this comes with you. Then that's the loudest voice you hear. So you are now just taking ownership, and you're saying negative talk will not be louder than my intentional voice. I'm going to do this every single day. So no matter what songs are playing in my head, no matter what programs I'm running, I have control over changing the channel. And I'm going to decide the program I'm going to run. And if you run it every single day, it becomes habitual. It becomes the new song that's stuck in your head. But you've created it. You've chosen it. So you're very welcome. And now all I'm asking is do it every day, and I can't wait to hear from you in 2 weeks.
Awesome. Thank
you. I have a question. Considering that, you know, we're going to go out of town for Thanksgiving, and so there may not be a time when you're even alone. Can you just do this in your mind without saying it out loud on one or two days when you're out of town and you can't actually be alone? Did that make sense?
Yeah. Well, when you're asking can you, I'm going to say yes, I can. Okay. However, I'm very practiced in it.
Okay.
So it's harder if you're somebody who really relies on that external stimuli. In other words, this is why when we do it in a group, everybody ultimately feels something.
Yeah.
There's never a person who, when we do this in a group, goes, I don't know, it's not working for me. Never.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have to stay with a person longer, right? I mean, you've seen that, where
yeah.
I go, where is it 1 through 10? And they go 4. And I go, stay with it, make it brighter, right?
Yeah.
Make it louder. And then eventually they get it. So it is harder when you're doing this by yourself. And then the next level of what we might call difficulty is doing this completely in your head with no external stimuli, even, you know, talking out loud.
Okay.
But is it possible? Yes. So the question is it worth it to try it rather than not doing it all? 100%.
Great. So if you could go in the bathroom and you could do it physically, even though you weren't screaming words out loud for everybody in the county to hear, then that's better. Everything you can add will be better.
Yes. And by the way, there have been many times that I've been in bathrooms to the point where somebody knocks on the door and goes, are you okay? Where I'm going through my ritual. So, yes. All right. So, Tammy, I'm really anxious to hear from you because you've done this before. You experienced something. I want to see what level this goes to for you next.
Very good.
All right. Until we speak again, be better, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.